I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to examine the continuing U.S. imperial expansion plan, regime changes. We're going to focus on two to begin. My panelists this day will be Russ Baker. Russ Baker is a multi-award-winning investigative reporter and journalist, as well known in the progressive movement for his analysis. His website is whowhatwhy.com, and over the past two decades, he has produced over 1,000 stories on a broad range of topics, from political revolutions to revolutionary humor. Among Russ's breaking investigations were the Hutu Tutsi massacres in Central Africa, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the overthrow of the Romanian dictator. He has received Society of Professional Journalists awards, the Mencken and the Common Cause Awards, and has served as on the adjunct faculty at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. His research into the rise and election of George W. Bush led to his bestseller, Family Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. He will be joined in the second part of our program by Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst under seven presidential administrations, from JFK's White House to that of George H.W. Bush. Among his duties was preparing the president's daily brief, which was a one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. He was responsible for the analysis of Soviet intelligence regarding Vietnam. Since retiring from government service, he has been one of our nation's most vocal peace activists and journalists. In 2003, he helped create Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. Ray's opinion pieces appear in many leading newspapers here and abroad, including a major section in an important book, Neoconned Again, dealing with America's war in Iraq. He holds degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham University, is a graduate of Harvard Business School, and also from Georgetown University, where he attended. His website is raymcgovern.com. I welcome both of you to our program, and we're going to begin with you, Russ. Our theme is, what is the U.S.'s ultimate goal in Libya, leaving a nation worse off than it was before orchestrating a regime change? And back in 2011, when President Obama led another U.S. operation for regime change of a sovereign nation in Libya following the attack on a U.S. embassy, you were covering and reporting on the events carefully with thoughtful analysis. And before the collapse of Gaddafi's government and his death, Libya was one of the most progressive, perhaps socially prosperous nations, certainly in North Africa. And also they had an enormous amount of water. He had spent more than anyone else I'm aware of in Africa building one of the most important water systems there. And also, he was different than other Arab nations. Repeatedly, the media portrayed Gaddafi as a war criminal, yet his crimes are small. I'm not saying the man was perfect by any means, but you compare him to, let's say, many of the rulers that we support, like Mubarak in Egypt for 33 years until he was thrown out. We were still supporting him right up until the moment he was deposed. And then we supported the Muslim Brotherhood. Now we support the military ruler who's taken his place, and we continue to give them weapons. Look at Saudi Arabia, one of the most repressive governments in the world, and also we have enough intelligence information out to establish that they have been supporting terrorists substantially in the last several years, and yet we do not call them out. There's virtually a blackout in the American media, mainstream media, and cable media about criticizing Saudi Arabia for its involvement in Syria and other countries. So take us on a journey, please. Take your time and trace for us the most important events for why we are in Libya today. Give us, for those who are not familiar, an overview of what Libya is like today compared to what it was. And did Libya, or Colonel Gaddafi represent a threat so great that we, the United States, using NATO as our proxy, with France and England and other countries joining in, did we need to do what we've done there? The form is yours.
Well, okay, thank you very much, Gary. First of all, what's happening right now is that a fuel depot near the airport in Tripoli is on fire, the United States has essentially pulled out, closed the embassy there. A number of other countries, most other countries, have gotten out, have gotten their foreign nationals out or told them to leave. Essentially, the capital, but also Benghazi, are really controlled by these warring militias. It's such a chaotic situation that the dominant militias aren't even from Tripoli. One is a clan from a place on the coast, another from up in the mountains. These are the kinds of groupings that were really sort of, you might say, kept at bay by a Gaddafi in his unifying the country. See similar situations, of course, in Iraq, and with all the obvious horrific things about Saddam Hussein, he also managed to keep these clans at bay. And of course, Syria, we've got essentially the same situation. All of those countries were ones where you saw some of the most advanced societies in the Arab world. You saw women given the most rights, and you saw minorities protected to a significant extent. And as you pointed out, of course, these sort of Ba'athist, quasi-socialist regimes where people were able to have very, very high lifestyles, in many cases, free education, often given free housing and other services. So while there is no question that the rulers in all of these places, to very differing extents, were problematical individuals, it is not clear how the West was expecting these countries to improve when you removed them. And with the situation with Libya interested me, Gary. If you start with the Arab Spring, of course, we had Tunisia, then we had Egypt. In both cases, we had what at least appeared at the time to be fully authentic uprisings of the people against tyrannical regimes. When it began in Libya, I have to say, I guess my first thought was, wow, this is sort of cool. This is just going to happen everywhere. Every country, the people are going to take control. Maybe it'll even happen in the United States. You can chuckle if you want. While I was looking at Libya, I was struck by the fact that the United States, which was so slow to acknowledge or in any way show support for the uprising in Egypt or Tunisia, was so quick to support the uprising there. And that just struck me as unusual. And I said, I wonder why the United States is so enthusiastic about this particular uprising. And so at whowhatwhy.com, our news website, we began digging into it. And we did so, I think, really with an open mind. We were trying to figure out why is the United States, Britain, France, those countries in particular, so enthusiastic about this. And as you may remember, it was a classic case of mission creep. At first, they said there was a spontaneous uprising. Then they said that Gaddafi was cracking down brutally and it was therefore necessary for humanitarian reasons. They initially installed a NATO no-fly zone so that his planes could not fly over Benghazi. And this kept expanding until we had a major NATO bombing campaign. You had, I believe it was 20,000 bombing sorties. I still haven't seen any good numbers on it, but I suspect many, many more people, many more died as a result of that than died as a result of anything that Gaddafi did in that period. In any case, the war kept expanding. Eventually what you saw was a full-blown Western invasion coup against Gaddafi. We've never had a good discussion in the United States about what happened. And I would also point out to your listeners that almost all of their favorite liberal left TV and radio shows supported this invasion. In fact, at Who, What, Why, we were virtually alone among news. I'm not saying we're the only ones, but among news gathering organizations, we're virtually alone in raising serious questions and doubts about what was really going on here and why. And there are many, many reasons, but I'll just sum it up this way. The West has always considered Gaddafi to be a problem because he was a kind of a classic nationalist leader in the mold of a Chavez or Castro or what have you, and he was very much oriented towards bringing together a whole bunch of these developing countries, not just in North Africa, but throughout Africa and elsewhere, and talking about the combined power that they had if they would only get together. He was talking about the possibility of all of these countries going off of the dollar. He was talking about the tremendous power they had with the enormous mineral wealth that they possessed. There were many, many examples. I'm sure when Ray comes on the program, he will speak to the specifics of those. But in any case, he was really kind of a model of somebody who was questioning the Western, if you will, imperial impulse in presenting an alternative. And so I think that was the biggest threat he represented. But today on Who, What, Why, we've got links to quite a few of the articles that we ran during that period where we pointed out many, many other things that were going on. And I'll just touch on several of them. Gaddafi had the best sweet crude oil in the world. France in particular was very, very interested in it. Italy had an inside track on that supply. There was some sense of competitiveness there. And we find very strong indications that France actually was the sponsor of that original so-called spontaneous uprising, that it was the French military and the French intelligence services that basically launched that, the United States and Britain joining in a little bit later. But some of the key things that were going on there, one is about Goldman Sachs. And to its credit, the Wall Street Journal was very early in picking up on this. Essentially, what had happened was Goldman Sachs had persuaded Gaddafi to invest a big portion of Libya's sovereign wealth fund with the firm. And amazingly, and this number sounds impossible, but somehow or other, they managed to lose, I believe it was 98% of all of the fund's money. And as you might imagine, Gaddafi was furious, and he took some action on it. And at that point, Goldman Sachs tried to convince him, this was during the worldwide economic collapse, convinced him that what he needed to do to recoup his money was to buy half of Goldman Sachs. Quite unbelievable, all reported in the journal there, and it did not get widespread attention. In any case, he then became very, very angry, and he felt that he had to recoup that fund somehow. You have to remember that the sovereign wealth funds are often what they use to provide the kinds of social and other services that keep the people complacent enough that a guy like Gaddafi is able to retain power. So, of course, this was very, very important to him. In any case, Gaddafi then said, well, if that's the way it's going to be, we're going to raise the cost to the Western oil companies that are in here. Well, as soon as that happened, the Western oil companies said, they went right to their friends in the Western capitals, and they said, it is time to turn the screws on this guy. And I would say that, as much as anything, was the situation when Arab Spring began, and it is my informed speculation that what happened was the tacticians in these governments said, hey, they want to have their Arab Springs, we can have our own Arab Spring, and we'll start with Gaddafi.
I just want you to go a little further on this point, because this is relevant. The left media, both the corporate left media and much of the left, supported it actively. I know programs on Pacifica supported the invasion of Libya. We did a series of programs showing the likely outcome, and we used the example of look at what happened when Saddam Hussein ran Iraq compared to what has happened since he was removed, and tribalism The violence between the Kurds, the Sunnis, the Shia, and now the terrorists supporting one group, and Iran another group, and the completely fractured country, over a million dead, over 4 million made homeless, and a completely unstable environment. Electricity's rarely on, and it's getting worse. We predicted it. Some people predicted it. No one wanted to hear that. And we said the same thing about Libya, that if you remove Gaddafi, even though he's not the nicest guy, what is the likely outcome? And the likely outcome we predicted, there'd be over 200 different major tribes all vying for power, and they would look at the assets. The United States and other countries would look at the assets much like the world powers looked at Russia at the conclusion of the First World War, when they had what was called the secret war, where the whites were against the reds, dividing it up. One wanted timber, one wanted gold, one wanted minerals. But they all went back in there, had another battle for years. And now we're seeing the same thing now in Libya. Why haven't the people on the left been called out and asked, look, you were wrong on this. Why don't you apologize? Is there anyone capable of apologizing when they've made a mistake? Your thoughts?
I don't think you're going to get an apology. The problem is too big. I mean, the whole reason that I started Who, What, Why was because I got tired of the whole sort of left-right thing, because they, in the end, so many of these institutions, these people seem to be what I'd call the loyal opposition, that they're really, you know, branches of the same thing. When it's their guy and it, you know, it's Obama, then the wars are all good. Obviously, when it was Johnson for a long time, et cetera, et cetera. When it was Clinton or any other Democratic president doing something like that. And so this partisan thing is just, it's so completely unhelpful, because you don't have any kind of authentic inquiry. You don't have any kind of, let's say, agnostic approach toward things. And it's just a formula for disaster. And I think that these shows we're talking about, these left, you know, news magazines and what have you, they just can't do it. They just cannot. They've got a base that they think, you know, likes whoever is on their side, whoever's in power. And I think that really is it. That is the final thing. And it's just impossible for them to get out of that formula. That's why our site is nonpartisan. Really, I think, in a sense, kind of non-ideological. In other words, what we're looking for is, what are the common things that we all share? And, you know, we all say that we want people everywhere to have human rights. We say that we want people everywhere to have a fair shake. We say that we don't want chaos in these places. I mean, any of these kind of measurements, they all go out the window. And as you point out, look at these countries. It's not just that the people who make these policies really are so sinister. They're actually incompetent. They are incompetent because they don't even get what they want. In other words, are they going now to be able to exploit the resources? I mean, that was what was behind all of these things. Are they going to be able to build the natural gas pipelines that Syria is about? Are they going to be able? Now, Ukraine is another place where the media is just telling a fake story, including the left media. It's not about Ukraine and Ukrainian rights. And I'm not saying those aren't important issues to people who live there, but these are not the things that matter to the policymakers from the West. And I have to say that the left media failed on Syria. They were virtually all foregoing in there too. And the other thing is, it's not just that it's partisan, but they get tricked, Gary. They get tricked by stuff like talking about human rights. Generally the Republicans don't talk as much about that. The Democrats talk about human rights, and the left gets tricked, essentially, or they get cornered, and they've got to support the moves that are on the side of human rights. They don't know how to call them on this stuff. They're just not deep enough.
Well, I know from one perspective that many of the people who call themselves on the left are really nothing more than Clinton, Obama, corporate Democrats. That's MSNBC. I saw that when Chris Hayes last week had to address on behalf of the network and hence the administration why the reporter who was trying to report honestly on what that reporter experienced in Benghazi was wrong. And you think at some point, I'm sure he represented a different ideal. But once you start getting the rewards for being in the media, and you would know this, you either self-censor or it's explicit or implicit, there are certain topics you can't deal with. For example, on the ideological left, meaning those who have what I call the left's 1%, they are not true liberals, though they will touch on certain liberal themes. They're very clever at how they do this. Most listeners will not know this, but they won't touch on vaccines. They won't touch on the drugging of our children. They won't touch on the corruption within the administration in power. They will not actively involve their audience in demonstrating against policies like the spying, the intelligence state, funding for Israel and other regimes. They stay away from those topics, and because they never talk about them, the public is not aware of their position on them. But I happen to know that they do not support these. For example, and then I'll get off this, I sent to every single journalist in the United States on television and radio copies with an article of my multi-award-winning documentary, Gulf War Syndrome Killing Our Own, Friendly Fire, and American Veterans Forgotten and Betrayed. Not a response, not from Keith Olbermann, and they all got them. I sent them also Silent Epidemic, about our vaccines, Autism Made in USA, and Vaccine Nation, which challenges the safety and efficacy of vaccination. Now, mind you, I don't throw things together. There's a great deal of scholarship that goes into what I do, and these are vetted, and we have independent scholars and residents like Richard Gale that review everything and make sure that we have not left anything out that would show bias. Not a single word about vaccines. We did a lot about nuclear and went no support whatsoever against nuclear. So there are at least 20 topics that you can't get the so-called left media, and don't even begin to talk about Juan Williams and Alan Coleman, some of these other people. These are very good corporate, democratic, liberal spokespersons, but they're not the true independent and progressive voices. So I've seen this firsthand because I've been on WBEI for 38 years. I'm on every single day, and I see gross bias on the part of some individuals because of what they won't tackle. And then you start looking at their connections. You look at where they get their money. Millions, tens of millions of dollars some of these people made. You know, it's phenomenal. But you never go into that. You'll never see anyone touching it. The Nation magazine won't touch this stuff either. They'll touch other things, which is fine. These are the things they won't touch. Your thoughts before we go on to the next issue.
Sure. Well, I mean, I've experienced that my entire career, and I have written for and worked with a lot of the entities that we're talking about, and they love to have my stuff as long as I only covered certain things and not other things. And typically, when I went a level deeper, they said, oh, well, there was no interest in that. And as you know, I think I've talked on your show about my book, Family of Secrets. I mean, that book came out 5 years of research on the story behind the story, behind the story of the Bush years and what really had happened and who was really behind that. And everybody was so excited, and people would say to me, oh boy, I hope you really slam the Bushes. And I said, well, it's not a partisan book. It's an investigative history, but I think you'll be shocked and amazed by what I found. Well, they sure were, because it wasn't just a partisan screed, but it really went into the fabric of the sort of corporate security state and how it is woven into everything. And by the way, the media, I think we should talk for a second, Gary, about Operation Mockingbird, the CIA program to have assets throughout the American media. This is all very well documented. We don't know when and if it ever ended. I often wonder whether they still have assets in television, radio, newspapers, magazines, what have you, or if they even need it anymore, because, as you say, the sort of self-censorship is so powerful. People know, even you know, but even with my book, friends of mine would say to me, I think you should drop, you know, I had that section in there about how George H.W. Bush couldn't remember where he was when Kennedy was shot, and I got so intrigued by that, I spent years trying to find out where he was, resulted in 5 chapters of new information on the Kennedy assassination. Such shocking stuff to me, to people I know. It was so shocking. You think, you know, the media loves well-documented, shocking things. I mean, that's what news is. They said, you know, we can't run this stuff. It's just too heavy. And that really is what it's about, that what you're getting out there is you're getting a light, L-I-T-E, version of reality, unfortunately.
What can you tell us about this renegade general of the Libyan National Army, General Haftar, who is claimed to have been groomed for years by the CIA while living right outside of Washington, D.C. in Virginia in the 1990s? Is there evidence that Haftar is similar to Ahmed Chalabi, a total tyrant, who the Bush cartel and Cheney attempted to install in Iraq after Saddam's fall?
You know, the thing with Haftar is that he was an officer in Gaddafi's forces. There's a somewhat murky tale of how he ended up turning against Gaddafi, but involved the war with Chad to the south of Libya. And he essentially appears to not have followed Gaddafi's orders. In any case, he was captured, and then the Central Intelligence Agency saw an opportunity because he and his command were understood to be negatively disposed toward Gaddafi, that they could maybe take these guys and build a force against Gaddafi. Eventually, through an indirect path, they were brought to the United States, and this is scores of these officers were resettled throughout the United States. And appear to have been given their sustenance. Haftar himself was not resettled just anywhere. He was resettled just down the road from Langley, Virginia. There's a quote in one of our articles there. One of his good friends says he doesn't really know what he does for a living. And there he was living in the United States for basically a couple of decades and just on tap for when they needed him. And they sent him back after Benghazi, and he was to be the military leader of the rebellion. And there were a lot of ups and downs within the power struggles within the opposition there, but he is very much – I was just interviewed about him a month ago, and he was now being mentioned again as somebody they were going to try to put in power. I have to say I have not followed the last few weeks, things have been so chaotic there. I don't know what his standing is, but – I think there is no question at all that the CIA has these surrogates ready to go for many, many of these countries.
Okay. My last question before we go to Ray McGovern, then I want you to hold on because I want to come back on a final issue. But when you look at, and Ray McGovern is going to talk about the growing tensions of a new, not a hot war, but a cold war between the U.S. and Russia. And yet one of the pieces that is important in the Ukraine scenario, particularly regarding the downing of the Malaysian airline, is the rabid misinformation and propaganda coming from Obama and John Kerry and U.S. corporate media. But what are we being told by the mainstream media regarding Libya that you have uncovered as misleading or blatantly untrue? And regarding Libya, what does the White House and the Pentagon want us to believe? Finally, when you look at the regimes and the militant revolutionary groups the U.S. has been propping up and sponsoring, particularly now during the Obama administration, there's a pattern of all of them being extremist. Al-Qaeda-related groups in Syria and Libya, suggestions that the U.S. is backing the Sunni fundamentalist ISIS in Iraq, neo-fascist extremists in the Ukraine, militant radical terrorist factions in Libya. And when you look at this pattern, and go back to Clinton, look what he supported and the media lied about in Kosovo and Yugoslavia. What does this tell you?
Well, I mean, as far as Ukraine goes and misinformation or disinformation or a rush to judgment, the thing that struck me reminded me, I mean, you know, when we were looking at Libya, I don't know if you remember this, most people have forgotten it now, but at the time there was a story that Gaddafi was behind ordering mass rapes. And this story made it all over the world. It was in practically all media. And it really turned a lot of people against Gaddafi in the international community. Today, people don't even remember why they decided he was such a bad guy, but that was one of the factors. We dug into that, Gary, and we found that that story was not even true. In Syria, they brought it out again, that old chestnut. And they again said there were mass rapes. We investigated, and we found that the people who were saying that admitted that they had no proof of it. With Ukraine, the rapidity with which they assigned blame for the downing of that plane. And I must say, I was waiting to see somebody to compare it with the downing of TWA Flight 800, where eyewitnesses saw a projectile headed at the plane. In the United States, they said, let's not have a rush to judgment. They basically sort of suppressed those eyewitness accounts. A total double standard. And it's very distressing. By the way, Anderson Cooper on CNN briefly said he compared what happened in Ukraine to the situation on Long Island. And he said, where TWA Flight 800, which was shot down. He went to a break, he came back, and he profusely apologized for that. I wondered if that was really an accident on his part, but he came back. He didn't just correct himself. He actually felt that he had to say, I'm terribly sorry that I said this.
I appreciate these comments. Please, thank you. Please stay on hold. We'll be back later. Let's now shift over and go to Northern Virginia and say hello to Ray McGovern. Nice to have you with us, Ray.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be back with you.
Ray, I want us to be able to go back and unravel the U.S.-Russian relations and the emergence of a new Cold War, albeit so far headed towards economic conflict rather than arms. I feel there's a deep foreboding when the U.S. is willing to align itself with and militarily and economically support some of the most despicable political elements on the planet, such as the racist neo-fascist groups now in power in Kiev, such as those who pledged themselves to the Nazi legacy of Stefan Bandera's reform of the Nazi Ukrainian Galicia SS, which was directly responsible for the slaughter of countless Jews, Gypsies, and Soviet Russians. And this is a very dangerous moral game in the U.S. that they're playing that could come back and lethally sting us in the future. Furthermore, it undermines everything the average American citizen believes this country stands for. And now we are also fully supporting the destruction among many leaders and peoples around the world, crimes against humanity being inflicted upon Gazians by Netanyahu's extremist administration. Your thoughts on the ethical and inhumane path the White House is following at this moment, by supporting reactionary political factions and terrorist group governments simply because they have bought into the Washington Wall Street agenda. Take your time.
Well, thanks, Gary. It is a pretty dismal picture you portray, and unfortunately it's quite accurate. I'm afraid in watching John Kerry and our top spokesman that they're giving hypocrisy a bad name. You point out that the people that led the U.S. and EU-sponsored coup in Kiev on the 22nd of February were led by Nazi stormtroopers, really, fascists that are well known to be fascists. And this is not just a figment of my imagination. The UN and others have singled out these people, Europeans have, as being the worthy successors of Stepan Bandera, who, as you noted, was a collaborator of the Nazis and took care of the extermination of many Jews, as well as many Russians and new Ukrainians. So those are the people who led the coup, and they're still in power. And when I say in power, I'm not exaggerating. There were four or five key posts in the new coup government as a result of the coup d'etat on the 22nd of February, that belonged to these proto-fascists, these Nazi legacy folks. And we know what they did down in Odessa in early April, the setting of fire of the trade union building there, trapping at least 60 or 70 folks and burning them, and the ones that tried to get out being shot. And all the while, the Ukrainians are singing Nazi or Ukrainian national songs. It's fairly bad, and this is something that has not wended its way into the what the so-called mainstream press. But before I forget, there's a very good article on all of this by Stephen Cohen, who is one of the Russian experts that I admire the most. He taught at Princeton, now at NYU. And if you look in the 30 June issue of The Nation, you can find chapter and verse on who these people are, where they come from, and what they aspire to do.
For those that don't believe the New York Times, Washington Post, Fox, CNN, and all the other megaphones for the U.S. government's interpretation of events, the big question in people's minds is why? The U.S., NATO, hardly innocent of crimes against other nations, untold deaths. Russia has not invaded anyone since the collapse of the Soviet Union, except retaliating when it or its interests were attacked, such as repelling Georgian troops. And many are now saying that what the U.S. ultimately wants is to sow seeds for a regime change in Russia. And then who is next after Russia? China, Brazil, all the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, that are now wooing developing nations away from the U.S. economic corporate interests. So what do you believe is the reason for U.S. threats against Russia?
Well, there are two basic ones. One is that at the end of the Soviet Union, when the Berlin Wall fell in November of 1989, and then the Soviet Union itself collapsed a year later, there was an incredible opportunity for genuine peace, as George H.W. Bush put it, from Portugal to the Urals. Now, that is probably the most significant event of my lifetime, and I'm coming up on 75, Gary. I couldn't believe it. George W. Bush, even before the wall fell, talked about a Europe whole and secure, a whole and free. And when the Berlin Wall fell, he called up Gorbachev, the progressive leader of Russia, and said, look, and these were his words, I'm not going to dance on the Berlin Wall, end quote. What I am going to do is reassure you that we're not going to take advantage of all your troubles. But we have our own concerns, Mr. Gorbachev, and so I'm sending my Secretary of State, James Baker, to Moscow in early February. We hope that you will receive him and discuss how we proceed from here. Now, even before that, George Bush invited Gorbachev to a summit meeting. It was only 3 weeks after the fall of the Berlin Wall, they met in Malta, and they decided that they would take advantage of this opportunity for peace, that there were reassurances, that, again, George H.W. Bush would not take unfair advantage of the troubles the Soviets were encountering, but in answer to, in return for that, he expected certain things from the Russians. Now, when James Baker arrived in Moscow in early February 1990 now, and of course Jack Matlock, our U.S. ambassador to Russia, was there, not only in Moscow, but in Malta for the summit, well, they met with not only Gorbachev, but Shevardnadze, the foreign minister, in other words, James Baker's counterpart, and a deal was struck. It was a quid pro quo. What was the quid? We wanted the Russians to recognize a unified Germany within NATO. Now, put yourself in Gorbachev or Shevardnadze's shoes, Gary. Here they are representing a country that had lost 25 million, that's million with an M, people in World War II. They had suffered from the invasion, Napoleon, the siege of Leningrad, And it was they, the Russians, that turned the Nazis back at Stalingrad and then at Kursk in that famous tank battle. And so here they were faced with the bugaboo, a reunited Germany. They were afraid of that. And so was I. I have to confess, Gary, I lived in Germany for 5 years, stationed there. And I didn't want a reunited Germany either. So, you know, you can magnify that 100 times by how the Russian perspective worked on this. In the end, Gorbachev said, all right, we will accept a reunited Germany. We will pull out of East Germany the 24 divisions we have there. That amounts to about 350,000 men, highly mechanized, highly capable, the kind that they used in 56 to put down the insurrection in Hungary, and in 68 to put down the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia. So they said, okay, we'll accept a reunited Germany in NATO, and we will pull our troops out of East Germany. That's the quid. Now, the quo for us will be your promise, which James Baker had already spoken, not to move NATO 1 inch farther east. James Baker, in his own memcon, admitted that he promised Gorbachev and Shevardnadze that the United States, and especially NATO, would not leapfrog over a reunited Germany. Well, fast forward to Bill Clinton, when he was running against Bob Dole, and Bob Dole said, you know, the Czech Republic and Poles and the Hungarians want to become part of NATO, and I think it's a great idea, great idea. And Bill Clinton went to his advisors and said, well, now, what do we do about that? And they said, well, not much, because, you know, we had this agreement with the Russians that we wouldn't leapfrog over Germany. And Bill said, well, you show me that agreement. You show me that. And guess what? By some quirk of history, we have Ambassador Matlock's notes on this, but we have no formal document signed by both sides. And when Clinton learned that, he said, what I'll do, just so I show to myself tough on defense, I'll say, well, I'll accept the Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary into NATO even before you can, Bob Dole. And so it started. Long story short, we added 12, count them, 12 new members of NATO, all to the east of Germany. And the original composition of NATO was only 12, so we doubled NATO in size. And we did that because we could. We did that not because there was any threat from Russia. They were falling apart. We did that because there were powerful forces in our country that did not want a Europe free and secure from Portugal to the Urals. And so, you know, that's a tragic, tragic circumstance, because what you have now is a direct result of that. Not only do we add 12 countries, but in 2008, so what's that, just 6 years ago, there were rumors that we were going to invite Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. And so Sergei Lavrov, who was foreign minister of Russia then and is still foreign minister of Russia, a consummate diplomat, he called the U.S. ambassador in. His name was Bill Burns. He's now deputy secretary of state. And he said, Ambassador Burns, are we still on?
Yes, we're still on.
Oh, okay. I heard a little thing indicating that we might have lost the connection. He said, Ambassador Burns, look, we hear rumors that you want the Ukraine in NATO. If you understand Russian, which you do, niet means niet. And that's the way Bill Burns titled his cable, his secret cable back to Washington. This was February of 2008. Now, how do we know all that? WikiLeaks. It was among the cables that Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, released to us. So we know what the Russians warned. And yet in April, the 3rd of April, 2008, NATO at its summit meeting in Bucharest issued a document saying Georgia and Ukraine will, no subjunctive mood here, will become members of NATO. Now that threw down the gauntlet. Well, we know what happened in Georgia. The Georgians were given a reason to believe by the neocon advisors around Bush that they could bloody the Russian nose and they'd get help from Washington. Well, they bloodied the Russian nose. They got no help from Washington. And Saakashvili, the fellow who began the hostilities there, met an ignominious end. What about Ukraine? Well, Ukraine is special. I mean, one has to understand, I mean, one can go way back in history to say that that's where Russian civilization began in the 9th century. But let's just go back to Catherine the Great. Now, Catherine the Great ruled at the same time that our revolution here in America transpired. And she extended the rule of Moscow all the way down to and including Crimea on the Black Sea. Why was that important? Well, because Russia finally had a warm water port that could take care of their navy in Sevastopol in Crimea. So that was the end of the 18th century. Now that is the headquarters of the Russian Navy. And not only that, it's the primary defense where they can send out their ships through the Dardanelles and the Bosporus, and they can act as a major power. Now, what are they afraid of? Well, Putin, let's use Putin's own words. They never find their ways into U.S. media, but this is what he said on the 17th of April while all this Ukrainian thing was going on. He said, look, it's bad enough that they have designs to bring Ukraine into NATO. Still worse is the notion that they could bring missile defense, in quotes, ships into the Black Sea and extend their missile defense system, which Putin noted is, in our view, Russian view, an offensive system aimed at jeopardizing our nuclear deterrent, because with this kind of missile defense, they can hit our ICBM bases. So Putin said this factored into our decision to honor the referendum by the people in Crimea and reincorporate Crimea into Russia. This figured into that decision. And then he said in sort of a lighthearted way, this was a press conference, he said, I'm sure that the U.S. Navy people, that the sailors from NATO, I'm sure they're just fine fellas. But, I don't want to have to visit them at their new base in Sevastopol, Crimea. I'd much rather have it the way it is now, where they can visit us at our base. Now, that was a very, very kind of jocular way of saying niet, and niet means niet. Right. Now, why does the U.S. want to do that? That's the big question, and I think that's the one that you're really asking, Gary.
Yes, but I have one very specific question.
Sure.
That I think is germane to all this. During the last 10 years, China has loaned the United States more money than any two countries combined, and it has not pressured them for return. But it has had an enormous market for cheaply made Chinese products, frequently using what amounts to slave labor in China, so to fill our Walmarts, our Kmarts, and other stores. And we then take it upon ourselves to start, in effect, intimidating or trying to intimidate China by creating additional bases in Saigon, in Cambodia, in New Zealand, Australia, other places in that ring, Pacific Ring. I think this is really stupid. Why in the world, if we want a world of peace, why are we posturing militarily instead of seeing what we can do on an environmental level, a humanistic level, to work with them? The same thing with Russia. We would never win a war against Russia. And Russia doesn't want a war with us because it would destroy everything that it has achieved. They have a business model very similar to our own, as does China now. Now, there's corruption in Russia, endemic. There's corruption in China, endemic. And there's corruption endemic in the United States. On that level, they all seem to concur. But now we want to get Russia surrounded by NATO, and NATO, in my opinion, is a complete criminal organization. It should have been disbanded a long time ago. We don't need it. So think of the untouchable military-industrial spying complex budget, $1.5 trillion, that nobody will touch on either side of the aisle. The media doesn't challenge this. When Bernie Sanders, who calls himself an independent, he may be independent, but he's a corporate independent. He's a corporate Democrat because he is a major sponsor of one of the most foolish procurements for this stupid airplane that we spent over $400 billion on with no good results, but it gives jobs to Vermont. So we don't have anyone standing up and saying, what the hell are you doing by putting all this money and trying to influence regime changes and getting strategic partners where that costs us hundreds of billions of dollars collectively around the world instead of rebuilding America, rebuild our schools, de-ghettoize our neighborhoods, try to bring jobs back and manufacturing back to rust towns and other places that have been deeply in debt. Why don't we put the money where it would be well used? Instead, no one is challenging how they're spending this money and the likely political outcome to alienate not just China and India. When you go after those two to alienate them, you're also alienating Brazil, you're alienating South Korea, you're alienating India. You're alienating a lot of people. Now, those people are not going to forget that you've really done something that they don't like. So the moment that China overtakes the United States in the next 12 to 36 months as the number one economic power in the world, mark my words, the dollar is dead. They're going to drop the U.S. as the reserve currency so fast, move to a mixed currency, and the world is already expecting, and investors are expecting it. And then look what we have gotten for all of this stupidity. Those are my thoughts. I'd like yours. And then I want Russ Baker to give his on this.
Sure. Well, I think, Gary, that one of your major premises was that if we want peace, then why do we do all this stuff? Well, yeah, I hate to hear myself saying this, but that's QED. You know, that's what is to be demonstrated, that we want peace. We have a hammer, the U.S. military, upon which we lavish all this money. And I'm glad you mentioned the F-35. That's an egregious example of frittering away $400 billion with which we could do so much in our own country. So what's driving all this? Well, the multinational corporations are very much behind what we've been doing vis-a-vis Ukraine. They'd very much like to get cheap labor out of there. They'd like to impose IMF restrictions on them. Austerity, you know, it'll look like Greece if they have their way. And the Ukrainians are slow to realize that. Why is this all happening? Well, I've come to the conclusion, Gary, that in the 50 years that I've been here in Washington, of all the changes I've seen in five decades, there's one that dwarfs all the others in significance, and that is that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media, and that is big.
Wow, I really
would
appreciate
anyone that. Be strong enough to speak out against all this? Well, theoretically, yes. But would they be like the tree falling in the forest with no one around to hear the crash? I'm afraid to say, but you know, the reality is yes. Now, the bottom line here for me, and you talked about what's in the offing for the coming years, you know, we have 9 grandchildren. I care deeply about what kind of situations they're going to face. And I, like you, believe that, well, let's use the old Chinese expression. The Chinese, when they were battling with the Russians as well as us, they used to say, you're going to come to a no good end. It always sounded weird. A no good end is in store for you. You're going to end up in the dustbin of history, okay? Now, I'm afraid that we are coming to a no good end unless we get out in the streets. Unless we get rid of a totally corrupt Congress, you know, the last straw for me was 100-0 vote to condone what the Israelis are doing now in Gaza. Where is their conscience?
Well, two things. We're near the end of our program, Ray. Two things. Okay. I don't see people in the streets. We're not there yet in our consciousness where we hope to be. And Congress is beyond corrupt. I believe it's the largest group of sociopaths meeting on a daily basis on the planet. So I don't see them changing themselves. Russ Baker, your final quick thoughts on the same question, please.
Oh, boy. How to do this fast. Two things. I constantly note that the products that I find here in the United States that I want are either from countries that can do them cheap, like China, or they're from places like Spain or Scandinavia. And I wonder when we will realize that if we don't learn how to make things again, we're ever going to get out from under being a country that runs on a permanent war economy. That is one thing. The second thing I would say is that I think all of us are culpable. Number one, because we don't recognize that this country has not really been a functioning democracy for a very, very long time. I think that the media that we're all critiquing are guilty of this, including the liberal left media. I don't think they really talk about the almost complete absence of real viable democracy in this country. And the last thing I think is a kind of a selfishness on the part of we, the people. And this goes to a lot of what the economy is about very short-sighted decisions we make, about our desire to protect a very, very comfortable lifestyle, and our unwillingness to contend with extremely uncomfortable truths. I see this almost every day. I talk to people, and they tell me, what you're telling me is just too upsetting. I don't want to hear about it.
Russ Baker and Ray McGovern, thank you both for sharing your insights on the Progressive Commentary Hour.
You're most welcome.
I'm Gary Knoll. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
On the oceans and upon high seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby us.